accession number 18802, reel 20.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 19. You were telling me about the wire fence around the perimeter.
Yes, it was very much what you might call a traditional barrack fence. It wasn't specially constructed for sort of anti-terrorist arrangements.
Was that the way you conceived of your role then, being really one of anti-terrorist activity rather than counter-insurgency or anti-guerrilla warfare?
How do you change those definitions?
Depends on the level of threat to some extent.
Yes. No, I think we're talking of an insurgency. And, I mean, if you transferred what we thought we were doing in Aden to Malaysia, as I later became when I went there after Aden, the fashionable phrase there was counter-revolutionary warfare. Well, I'd never heard the phrase up till that minute, but I suppose that's what we were embarked upon.
You mentioned you put sandbags around the tents, and another way of guarding against attack, of course, is to dig slit trenches just outside the tent. Was any of that done?
No, the ground was very hard, and it made sense to build up. We built up to, I suppose, about that level.
About
the sandbags.
About 3 feet.
Yeah.
And that would protect you against mortar splinters, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Or indeed against sniping to a certain extent.
It would indeed, yeah. I mean, nothing is 100%, but it was pretty good protection.
Now, you're mounting all sorts of different operations, but you would obviously have to leave behind a force to actually guard and hold the camp. Roughly how many men would you normally reckon to need to keep your desert camp secure?
I don't think we ever worked it out quite like that. I think we worked out that X number of people were needed for various patrol, etc. activities, and that we always had to have a sort of, whether you call it a reserve, whether you call it people resting, whether you call it alternating on and off duty. I don't think we ever plan for an exact number to be looking after the base camp, but there were always enough. It's not a very satisfactory answer to your question.
You mentioned having to have a reserve, perhaps a quick reaction force, something of that sort. How big would that be, normally? Would you keep a company as a...
By and large, a company, yes. And I'd like to enlarge on that point, the quick reaction force, readiness, whatever you like to call it, states of readiness. I'd like to enlarge on that when we come to Northern Ireland in due course.
But did you have a readiness time in Aden?
A what, sorry?
Did you have your reserve in the camp at a particular readiness?
We did indeed, but I absolutely can't remember what it was. But certainly I refined in my mind, and indeed in practice, I refined all that very much as a result of experience in Aden. I refined that when we got to Northern Ireland, or when I got to Northern Ireland, rather. And again, it depended slightly on how things were going locally, but we had a very, very quick reaction force indeed, which is quite small, but sort of I mean, almost at 10 minutes' notice, probably a platoon's worth. And that's quick.
With a vehicle standing by?
Yes.
You said that the atmosphere was tense. What were the outward manifestations of this tension?
I think mainly for the expatriate local population who were worried about what might be about to happen. And I can't remember when we were there exactly what the political scene had arrived at. But if you remember, we're pretty close to the time of George Brown saying, you know, let there be no more Aden, let there be no more X, Y, and Z, east of Suez. And so I think probably that sort of feeling must have begun to percolate through the local population, by the expatriate population.
Well, the British government was becoming disinclined to carry on.
Yes. I can't state that as a fact, but I think I get the impression that was beginning to percolate through.
Were there outward signs of public hostility to the British presence or to your soldiers?
Not really, no. And we were there in considerable strength. And while some of the locals, the local Arabs, I've no doubt weren't at all pleased to see us, on the whole, they were prudent and didn't show it too much.
Did you see any signs of propaganda or political agitation?
No, but I'm aware there was some. And I cannot remember the name of the man who, I suppose, you know, within a year or so, had actually sort of become the leading light locally. I cannot remember his name now, but certainly he was vocal, but mainly amongst his own folk, and not too much as far as we were concerned.
Now, there have been persistent attempts to interfere in the internal political affairs of Aden by various foreign powers, in particular by Egypt, and also by the Yemen, and I think by other interested parties. Were you aware of any of that sort of thing going on?
I find it difficult to remember what I was aware of then and what I became aware of later. Certainly, later, I was very aware of Yemen, and nobody could be more surprised than me when Yemen became North and South Yemen, and Aden sort of was swallowed up. I was quite surprised when that happened. But looking back on it, I suppose it was probably inevitable. I think it just shows really how naive some soldiers were about what they were being asked to do and what the political scene was against which they were operating.
Could this be, would this be because soldiers were not interested in politics, or could it be that you were too busy with the day-to-day management of the battalion, or...?
Certainly not the first. We were very busy. No, I suspect it's... we hadn't really hoisted it all in, what the political scene was. And I suppose, to an extent, it's a generation thing, because, you know, I'd been brought up in the days... I mean, to put it crudely, of a British Empire, Aden being an important part of the British Empire, and a coaling station, etc., etc. And I just accepted that Aden was our business. Well, looking back on it, I suppose it wasn't.
It was a business that was being taken over.
Yeah.
Who was actually giving you your orders? Was this coming direct from Brigade Major at Brigade Headquarters?
No, the Brigade Commander himself took a very active part. Although I say it, and perhaps shouldn't, he wasn't a wildly inspiring character. But he did play an important role, and he did play a personal role, and so we really got our orders direct from him.
How did he do this? Did he have regular conferences or briefings?
Yes, and also he came round quite a bit, and one was summoned individually rather than collectively from time to time, you know, to discuss what was going on and to talk about it and perhaps change tack a bit. So there was his level, which was called the Aden Brigade, and then there was a GOC, Land Forces, who was a man called John Cubbon when we first went there, who was a splendid infantry officer, who was succeeded by another man whose name has, I'm afraid, gone out of my head, who eventually became a lieutenant general in charge of the Gulf, I think. But he had a... Whereas John Cubbon had been a very direct infantryman. Indeed, when I arrived there and I was going off to sort of touch my hat to him, everybody said, oh, he'll eat you up before breakfast. And I said, oh, well, we'll see how we get on. Actually, I got on extremely well with him because I think he appreciated what, A, the battalion was trying to do, and B, what I was trying to do with and for the battalion. Anyway, we got on like a house on fire. But his successor, I didn't understand a word he talked about, mainly, because he kept talking about things like Troy 17, and that meant nothing to me at all.
Does it mean anything now?
I've no idea. I mean, it just wasn't my way of conducting business.
What did John Cubbon want you to do? What were his overall general directives to you?
I think his first priority probably was to produce a good, well-disciplined, responsive battalion. That was his first requirement. And I think everything else flowed from that. And indeed, since that's what I wanted to do anyway, I didn't find it too difficult to undertake those orders. I mean, I don't think it wasn't put quite like that, but I think that's what the message I went away with.
Sounds as though the idea was that if the battalion was well-trained and responsive, it would do the right thing automatically.
Exactly.
In the operational sense.
Exactly. Mm. And I believe that to be true.
Now, you mentioned carrying out searches, roadblocks, patrolling. Searches depend to a great extent upon intelligence.
Yes.
Where were you getting that from? And what quality was it?
It wasn't very good, I think, in answer to that part of the question. And we didn't have our own access to special branch. We got it all on the military net through brigade headquarters. And I don't think, looking back on it, that the intelligence setup was as good as it might have been. But if you ask me to say how could it have been improved, I absolutely haven't the faintest notion, because I don't know enough about its background.
You're saying you got your intelligence via brigade headquarters. Presumably this came from a variety of different sources. Interbrigade. Did you have an intelligence gathering role yourself?
No. Not that I recollect. I mean, except in the ordinary way of business. I mean, you know, when having carried out an operation of some sort, it had some result or other which got reported, and some of that had an intelligence aspect to it.
What about relations with the local police? Not just the special branch, but the ordinary police, if there was such a thing in Aden. Did you have anything to do with them?
Very little. Not enough, I think, is the answer to that question. But then I suppose each colony, if that's the right word, varies in the way it approaches these things. It varies in its training of its own police force and the efficiency of its own police force, and indeed the reliability of its own police force. And I think that if one was to compare Kenya on the one hand, Malaya on the second hand, and Aden on the third hand, certainly the police I dealt with in Aden, and there weren't very many, would come third in the batting order. But that is a rather generalized statement, probably not based on sufficient evidence.
But it's a personal impression.
Yes.
What was it, in what ways were they inferior to their colleagues in Cyprus and Kenya and Malaya? Sorry, forget Cyprus, but you mentioned Kenya and Malaya. What was it about them that struck you as being less impressive?
I don't think they were so well trained, and I think they were lazier.
Were they Europeans, these chaps you were dealing with, or were they Arabs?
Arab or Pakistani, mostly.
Did you have a mechanism for coordinating and clearing your operations with the police to avoid possible conflicts of interest?
No, it's a very interesting point, that, because, again, looking at the other places we've been, or I've been, one very definitely had a personal connection with the police. My recollection of Aden is that it was... we didn't have our own clearance arrangements. It was very much done through brigade quarters.
So it was done through a formal military structure rather than an integrated military stroke police headquarters.
That's my
system.
Recollection. Certainly, I mean, there was no question of, you know, a joint operations room, say, for the battalion on the one hand and the police on the other hand.
That had been firmly established in Malaya, hadn't it?
Yes.
But in Templar's day and beyond.
Yes.
What about the local civil authorities as opposed to the police, the municipal administration?
I don't recollect having anything to do with them at all. I called on the commander-in-chief. I called on the governor, and I think that's about where it finished.
So nothing to do with the mayor or...
No.
Mayor and corporation of Aden Town?
Absolutely nothing at all. In fact, I don't even recollect if there was such a body.
What was the urban terrain like from the point of view of conducting operations?
Well, I mentioned earlier on the Mala Strait.
Yes.
And the Mala Strait, as its name implies, is a long straight road going through the centre of Mala, which is the, what you might call the smart part of Aden. And that was more or less flat, as I recollect it. But there were quite a lot of hilly bits as well round about, and including one or two really quite severe hills. And then, of course, as you got nearer the... I never quite know quite how to describe it. I was going to say the coast, but it's all quite close to the coast. But there was another smart area, which was sort of the seaside part, let's call it. And that was, some of that was quite hilly, as well as sort of very flat bits. I think one would just say it was a mixed terrain, one or two very main roads, which were had people living on both sides of them, one or two pretty secondary roads and a whole heap of pockmarked roads of one sort or another leading into sort of local ghettos almost.
Would these be, you say ghettos, would these be quarters with a specific character or a specific population?
Local Arab.
What about Crater? What was that like?
I didn't go to Crater a great deal. I don't recollect it very much, except to say it was a pretty unpleasant place. I don't think it's ever been quite the same since Mad Mitch went there, if you remember him.
Colonel Mitchell of the Argyll and Southern Highlanders.
That's right. And he and I, funnily enough, worked together in London once. But Crater, I think Crater had a very bad name at the time we're talking about. But on the other hand, if you talk to bankers and people like that, they would say that Crater was quite a nice place to live and that it had got a worse name than it ought to have. I'm afraid I'm just skating round the point. I really can't tell you very much about Crater.
What was it laid out on, a European pattern, or was it laid out on an Arab pattern as a settlement?
I think one would say mixed. There was definitely a European area.
Yes.
But it was a different world, really, there, because whether you're talking about Crater, whether you're talking about Big Aden or Little Aden, the main European companies lived a completely different life from anything I'd ever encountered before. I mean, to give two silly examples, one of the banks in Crater, I forget which one it was now, but when I talked to the manager there, he quite definitely said that his visitor's book was inspected by head office, and if he didn't have enough people to stay or to entertain, he got a rocket. And that was, you know, in the middle of internal security operations and so on. Little Aden, BP, for some reason or other, asked me to dinner there, and I had to go in my, more or less my operational kit, wearing a pistol, in a staff car with an escort. I mean, it was wholly operational. And yet when I got there, I forget, we sat down to dinner, about 24 people, I suppose, something of that sort. And there was a uniformed servant behind every chair. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it, because my world had never been like that. They regarded it as the most normal thing in the world, with wonderful silver, glass, furniture all over the place. Different world.
Did these Europeans live in separate compounds, or were they living cheek by jowl with the population of Aden?
I can't be sure of my facts, but I think mainly compounds.
Did they have their own local security arrangements? Did they have armed guards, for example?
Tended to, yes. Yes.
Do you remember at the time when you were about to be deployed whether you got any sort of formal threat assessment on which to base your expectations and operations?
No, I don't think so. I took over from Royal Scots, which, funnily enough, was my, if I had not gone to the Rifle Brigade as I did, my family regiment. First war and before, and indeed I found the signal officer of the battalion, the Royal Scots, was a cousin of mine who I'd never met, and we flew in, and the same aircraft that flew us in were flying the Royal Scots out, so the handover was pretty rapid and included a splendid meal called tiffin, which I hadn't had for some years. and always produces a grin whenever I produce the phrase, but it exactly described what we were about to eat. But no, I mean, I drove round as quickly as I could through the main part of Aden with the commanding officer of the Royal Scots, and we discussed it all, and he said what he did, and I asked him various questions, say, why do you do it this and not that, and I took over, and he flew off, and I saw him off. And so that was the takeover. I don't think threat assessment in formal terms really came into it.
Do you remember if you did generally sort of follow on doing the same sort of things the Royal Scots
yes.
had done?
Yes.
Did you make any changes at all to what was done or the way in which you did it?
I think inevitably, you know, on a day-to-day basis, things changed. On a day-to-day basis, probably a different number of people were allotted to different tasks from what had been so the week before. But that's life. And I suppose one of the key words I've gone through life using is flexibility. And I've tried to practice that.
When you were doing searches, how were you directed? Did you always act upon specific intelligence targeting particular buildings or individuals, or did you sometimes search specific areas?
We were mainly directed to go to some place or other and to search it, but just occasionally there was what you might call random searching. And of course, in terms of relations with local population, and this is expressing a personal opinion, random searching probably does more harm than anything else one does. Whereas if you can search on, even if it's on pretty poor information, but if you can at least say, well, you know, we have reason to believe that, I think on the whole it does less damage to local relations.
Did you ever actually find anything significant on a random search?
No. One really does. And the same thing applies in Northern Ireland as well.
You mentioned damage. Do you mean psychological damage or physical damage or both?
Inevitably there's a certain amount of physical damage. You can get over that by paying for it. No, I meant psychological damage with the local population, just relations, really.
And you mentioned that when you were doing searches, you were looking for the Belgian blindicide.
Amongst other things, yes.
Amongst other things. What other things would you be looking for?
Or rifles, pistols, possibly even machine guns.
Did you find many weapons during your
no.
time?
No.
What about things like papers or specific individuals? Were you also looking for those? Did you have a P-file of suspect characters to look out for?
No, we didn't. Interestingly enough, I'd never thought about it till this minute. No, I don't recall such a thing. Whereas, you know, in other places one's been, quite definitely we were looking for individual people. I mean, in Malaya and Northern Ireland in particular.
And what about things like documents or clandestine printing presses or that sort of thing? Were they targeted?
I don't remember them being a target at any stage.
You mentioned also doing roadblocks. What was the purpose of those?
I'm tempted to say you might well ask. Sometimes, if there'd been an incident, I mean, obviously, an obvious instant action was